Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off! It started! That's Fan Club. We just talk about how professional we are and completely missed the start of the show. And here we are. My name is Nick. This is
Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to Nick and
Nathaniel Metcalf's
Fan Club on FUBARradio.com/org. First rule of Fan Club, tell your friends about Fan Club. Second rule of Fan Club, please.
For the love of God, for the love of Mike, tell your friends.
If you've told all your friends already, make some...
Tell them again, they're not listening.
Make some new friends, tell them again! I have been on a healthy eating kick, if that's what you call it, and I have just eaten a salad and drank very quickly a bottle and a half of Pepsi Max Cherry.
What size bottle are we talking?
Just one of the little ones, 500ml.
Yeah, and, that's busy, isn't it?
I think I'm going to be sick at some point, but I will nevertheless forge ahead and try and deliver 2 hours of five-star family fun-sized Fan Club.
And how are you feeling? Do you feel hungry all the time?
No, I feel really good. I feel really good. As I'm going back to the gym with my mate Kenny. Mm-hmm. I'm just eating. I've got like a month until I'm 40. I've lost about a stone, and I've got about another stone and a bit to lose before I'm at my preferred ideal weight. But my trousers keep falling down, so I'm sort of like, yeah, that's great.
That's good.
I feel great when my trousers fall down. I don't know about you. I think it was because I always wanted to join a circus. So, you know, I had to make do as a stand-up comedian because clowning wasn't as big back in 2007. But it's making its way back, I find. Do you remember that?
Isn't your personal trainer Kenny? Is he like Dwayne Johnson's stunt double or something?
He was, I think it was for Hercules. He was Dwayne Johnson's body double.
Oh, right. So when Dwayne Johnson was feeling a bit like, oh, I'm not feeling too good today, could you do it, Kenny?
Yes. Well, he's not as bulky, but he is fucking lean, right? But what he is he's the same height, and he's got a very similar skin colour.
Wow.
So they used him for lighting and stuff. So that, but yeah,
You ever seen that Hercules film?
No, they made two, didn't they? They made two the same year. Two Hercules. There was one that had Dwayne Johnson in, and then there was one that was directed by Rennie Harlin.
Oh really? I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, and it was absolute dog dust. Anyway, so it's really nice because, you know, it's really nice to actually just sort of like do so. I think that what's happened is I put on some weight during lockdown, and then just by kind of doing any exercise and just eating properly, all my COVID weight has sort of like dropped off. And now I'm at the weight I was before. I don't know if I am, though. I think I look a lot skinnier than I did.
Different than you did last week.
Yeah.
You started by then. It's time to... You look physically different.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, I can see myself on the Zoom call and I look different. But, it feels good. It feels good. But you're doing loads of exercise as well, aren't you? You're cycling everywhere.
I've got a bike, so I'm trying to go... But I'm not doing... I reckon all I'm doing is maintaining whatever current weight I am. I don't really weigh myself or anything. Perhaps I should, but I do pretty much every day I'll go around the park, and if I'm going somewhere that I don't have any big definite time to get to, if I'm just going up, you know, I'll go up the West End or something like that. I'll go on a bike because it doesn't really matter how long it takes. Even though now I'm doing it in about, it's about as quick, if not quicker, than getting the tube to do that distance. And yeah, so that's fun. And I quite like going on a bike. I didn't think I'd like it. It's like flying. It's like flying. It feels like you're doing something. It's at a different space.
It's like flying
somewhere quickly. I think I've done it since I was a kid. It's a genuinely odd experience, I find, cycling. It feels slightly otherworldly.
Well, cycling's like flying a plane, isn't it? You never forget the first time that you flew a bike. Something like that. Do you enjoy it? Because I am absolutely fucking shit scared of bikes.
I was scared of doing it, and I'm slightly worried at how much I'm getting used to it, and that is a worry that when the fear goes away entirely, I'll be a bit, you know, putting myself in some danger.
Yeah.
But hopefully.
I mean, I've talked about it before, but I was psychologically scarred from a bike incident when I was 9 or 10, and I never went back. Yeah, terrifying contraptions. And I feel the same way about about bikes as I do about cars. Can you drive?
No, never.
You never even tried though.
No, I sort of should have done.
But you've never sat behind a wheel, turned on the ignition, and done anything with the pedals.
Not in the least.
Now, why is that?
One of my mates turned 17, I think, and he passed first time, and he got a car, and I was like, "Great, you can just give me a lift. I don't need to."
Yeah.
I think it was like one of my mates could drive. And it was like, oh, great, sweet. That saves me some money. And he was the driver.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and only that was only for a short space of time. I don't really need, you know, I don't need a car in London. I've always lived in London.
Yeah.
If I live somewhere else, I might have a car. I wish I had a car when I was doing stand up more, because then it became a real ball ache. But by then, I think I've also got a bit of a fear, and I don't want to be, as an adult, I don't really want to be in a car with someone telling me how to drive.
Sure.
I find that kind of a bit like, I'm in a car with someone who knows something I don't, know something more than me. And I'd be a bit like, I feel very like, I can imagine I'm just being impatient at someone. But I'm sure they're not. I'm sure they're good uns and good people.
What? One of the reasons why you don't want to learn to drive is because you think that you're going to kick off at the driving instructor.
Not kick off. I think they will be like infuriated with me not knowing how to do something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not worried about that. I think I have a real difficulty. Like if you were to go, well, I realize this when I'm in the gym, and Kenny will go, right, do that to the left. And then I'll have like a working out period where I'm trying to work out what my left and right is. And I'll be confused. Right. So I get confused between my left and right. So when you have to make a decision really quickly about your left and your right, I have thinking time.
Yes.
Right. And it might be because I'm left-handed. I know that a few years, maybe like 5 years ago, my girlfriend at the time, we went to Brighton Pier and we played on Guitar Hero, right? And I found that quite difficult. But then she bought me like a secondhand Xbox for my birthday, and you can reconfigure it so you can play the guitar upside down. And what I learned was that I was actually better with like the Paul McCartney restrung guitar, like with a, you know, on Guitar Hero with the buttons.
Yeah.
So my right hand was better at doing the fretboard than, and I learned how to play guitar like with a right-handed guitar. And I've always had difficulty with the fingering, and it's And it was just sort of like, it was like just Guitar Hero. I was just like, do you know what? I would have probably been better off if I'd really strung a guitar and I'd have learned how to play the guitar better.
So you were left-handed, but you didn't know till you were...
No, I've always been left-handed.
Oh, right, okay.
But I just learned how to play the guitar right-handed.
Right, okay.
And I don't, and I think it's sort of like, I mean, I don't really, I think if you learn one way or the other, it doesn't really matter. But but I think that my right hand is probably a little bit more, it's weird. My right hand seems to be a little bit more dexterous than my left hand. So there's all of that. But when it comes to driving, I get flustered and confused and panicky. I think I've got sort of like, somebody
said... No, I have similar things, I think. I think I have a similar thing. Like, it's like, I obviously know, but I think I do have that kind of, was it proper? Like that sort of panicky type thing, I think, when someone's telling me things.
I think it's dyspraxia, which is like spatial dyslexia.
I definitely have that. I have a thing where I, you know, I can't play things like tennis. I can't tell how far a ball is away from me. I'll often hit my shoulder on doorways.
Yeah, I'm always walking into stuff. Mm. I'm not like clumsy, but like in my house, I'll sort of like walk into walls and stuff like that. And I just think... I've had driving lessons, not like proper ones, but my dad took me to sort of like an empty car park on a Sunday morning and stuff. And I was just fucking flustered, panicked. And it's not the best sort of like relationship to have with your dad when, you know, he's sort of like, you know, he knows best. And it's kind of like, if you think that the only thing that's stopping you from losing your temper with the driving instructor is the fact that you're strangers. Mm. If it's your dad, it's just like, you go from naught to fucking...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You just lose it. He's like going, no, don't... You know, he'd grab the wheel and you go, when in the fucking... when in any sort of scenario... when you're driving, is somebody going to be grabbing the wheel off you? And then you just like, do you know what? Fuck it, I won't bother. And then the years fly by, and then all of a sudden, you haven't learned to drive. Like four years ago, maybe 5 years ago, I was in France, and my dad took me for like a driving thing, down a country road, and I nearly killed us. In like 30 seconds, it was just sort of like I went up an embankment and then killed it. I was just like, do you know what? I don't want to learn to drive. I'm all right. I think I would be hazardous. I think I would be a danger to other people on the roads.
But I think I might have a similar thing with like having a personal trainer or something. I don't think I like things where people are telling me what to do.
Well, it's not like that though. I know exactly what you mean, right? But I did a job where I met Kenny, and I was sort of like interviewing him for something, and we got on really well. And then I did that food. I think we've mentioned it like a couple of weeks ago, but we did the food show. I put on a load of weight, and then as soon as I finished, I was just like, how do I get myself out of this situation? And I just got in contact with Kenny. I was just like, do you want to train me? And I started doing boxing, which I really enjoyed back then. But then I sort of kind of like just really wanted to do it for fitness.
Yeah. And, like you said, isn't it? Because you've already kind of established a relationship with someone.
Exactly.
Like a mate or something. It feels like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we only knew each other for that one day, but we got on really well. And then it was just kind of like, right, okay, he's my into going to the gym. But like, I mean, even in, because, so there's a gym downstairs in the building where I live. And even kind of like, at the moment, I think you're only allowed four people in at once. And there's people in the building that use the gym that are very aggressive. Mm. And it's just kind of like, and there was a guy that was in the other day, he was just slamming stuff around. Like, but just like being completely just sort of like anti. We were there first as well. So it was like, that's the thing. It's kind of like, I mean, I really enjoy going to the gym. If anyone out there wants to sort of like improve their health or anything like that, then I think, you know, don't be put off by the gym. There are other people there that will sort of like intimidate you and make you feel like a bit shit. sometimes. And even in kind of like, there's four people that are allowed in the gym at once, there's a guy that goes in there, just slams everything around. But you just think it's fucking ridiculous. And and I said to Kenny, you know, he's the reason why a lot of people wouldn't go to the gym, because of people like that, you know, where it's all about aggression and getting it out of your system.
Yeah, people making noises for no reason.
But I do when you're really getting to like the point where you just don't think you can do it anymore. You just go, you know, but mine is much more pathetic than aggressive. Do you know what I mean? It's more like a death rattle.
I think someone's hurt himself.
But I don't understand it. You know, I mean, I made a film about it, you know, my short film Killing Machine was all about kind of like toxic masculinity and stuff like that. But, yeah, I made a film about like, people in the gym being like intimidating and stuff like that. And I just think that, you know, if it's something that you want, you shouldn't let other people sort of, you've just got to put it into context. It's like, what you get out of it is bigger than what they take away from it, then do it. And you just sort of like put them out of your mind, really.
Riding a bike was a bit like that. I'd never done it since I was like 9 or 10 or something, and thought, I'm not even sure I can now, and I'll look foolish. So you don't do it.
It's public. You're learning something in public, right? So, I slept funny the other week, and I caught like a nerve in my back, and it's still not fixed, really, right? But so I just go in and do stretches, and some of the stretches are just exhausted. Do you know what I mean? Just from sort of like stretching, and you go, and then there's other people in the gym that are looking at you, and you go, fucking hell, you know. I hope nobody recognises me off Uncle. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of, it's just in there going, oh God, this is fucking publicly humiliating to be doing a stretch and breaking a sweat. Do you know what I mean? And it's the same with riding a bike. It's kind of like you're doing it in public. People can see you doing it. And you're kind of like self-conscious, and you have to kind of like go, yeah, that's the thing about the guy, right? He's down there and it's like, I'm shit at the gym and he's good at the gym. And it's like, why are you here? You're rubbish, right? But I've been hanging around with someone from up north, and I've adopted their accent, by the way.
Absolutely, you have. I was going to bring it up.
It's mental, right?
But it's also quite a soft northern accent. It's quite Alan Bennett-ish.
Sure. Well, I was talking to Mother.
You're basically that. I've been in the gym.
That's it.
I'm going to have a cocktail.
But the thing is, it's just kind of like, yeah, I am shit at the gym now, but I will get better, right? And every time you see me, I'm shit at the gym, right? I'm there, right? And you're there. I go to the gym when you go to the gym. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, yeah, I'm not as good as it, but I haven't been going as long, right? And it's kind of like, and I'm still turning up, right? Because I will improve. I mean, you know, it's just like, it's the same as, I'm just like saying, right? If you get it, before we talk about, you know, John Carpenter and Star Trek, I'm just like saying, if anyone out there is listening, it's hard, right? And it's miserable. And I hate going to the gym. But having my friend there to help me is good. And he just doesn't tell me what to do. You know, he sort of like goes, do this. Sometimes I'll go, I'm absolutely not doing that. And then I won't. but I'll always sort of like swap it for something else. He'll say, you going to do any more? We're going to do some more shoulder work. And I'm just like, going, do you know what? My shoulders are fucked today. I'm going to do leg work instead, right? So you'll swap it for like. And if you can't, you know, if you don't want a personal trainer, or you can't afford a personal trainer, then just go. They've got like gym equipment in parks as well. I just think that it's fun, and mentally it really helps me. Mm. Anyway, there you go. That's how I feel about that. I hate it, but I like it.
I think it's like, it's definitely a bit of exercise. And I think I do get something out of it. You get some, like, I think I quite like, especially when I started cycling, it was sort of real mid-lockdown and I hadn't really been out anywhere at all and had barely left the house. And as soon as you do go off on it, you go, oh, I feel better just being outside and, you know, getting a little bit of exercise, whatever that is. So I think it does do you good.
Yeah. Well, somebody tweeted me and they said that they were having depression and they were struggling. And they said they went to the doctor and the doctor said, go for a walk. And that, on the one hand, that is shit advice because it's kind of like dismissive. But on the other hand, actually going for a walk does help a lot of the time. Hmm. So, you know, there is something in it, but what you really want is someone to just listen and help you. But, you know, anyway, so if you're out there during lockdown and you're struggling, you're not alone. And, you know, do a bit of exercise and maybe that'll help a little bit. I mean, it's not a cure all, but it certainly helps me deal with it. Helps me deal with it. I'm not like saying it helps me deal with it. Okay, very good. Right. So what have you seen this week, Nathaniel?
Seen a bunch of stuff. Now, I'll give you...
Do you know what, Nat? This is the second week you've seen a bunch of stuff, and I'm very proud of you that you're finally pulling your weight. Thank you very much.
Oh, wait, it doesn't feel like I'm pulling my weight. It feels like I'm waking my life.
Okay.
I've seen The Mask, 1994.
Oh, it's party time. P-A-R-T-Y. Because I got it. I love Jim Carrey. No, fucking... Is it good?
I think what's really good about it that stops it dating too badly and being too 90s is because even in the 90s, it has that sort of 20s Tex Avery cartoon aesthetic. Yeah. So it doesn't actually feel like... It's got that thing like Dick Tracy has or something. It doesn't feel too 90s. It's quite... It's already set itself up to not be contemporary. So it's dated quite well.
Sure.
The last act is like silly. That it sort of just completely... It's almost like they've got to try and make a convincing story out of it when the first two-thirds are basically a vehicle for Jim Carrey, and that's fine. But at the end of it, it's almost like by trying to make a... It's almost like they're trying to make more plot out of it. You've got the thing where the bad guy ends up with a mask and things, and he has to learn to be himself. And it's all a bit like, oh... Okay, but it's almost like also inevitable. Like, of course, this is how this film ends.
Yeah, they've made it like a family-friendly kids film out of a very violent kind of just gory and quite disgusting comic book. I love the comic book when I was. I don't know which one I read. I think I read Return of the Mask. But I think that was the one that had the car exhaust stuff in it. He would sort of like shoot people to shreds, and there's just like loads of blood in it, and it was like really. And then they've gone, oh, well, so they're not really like for like. They've kind of like taken the gist of it, and then they've kind of. And is the Tex Avery sort of style in the comic book?
Yeah, a little bit, but it's sort of played up. And I quite like the idea that it's because it's what he's obsessed with. It sort of works very well in the film that it's got all these, like, you almost become more of the thing you are anyway.
Yeah.
He becomes like a sort of super Jim Carrey. But his whole thing is he's got, like, at his house, he's just got kind of Looney Tunes memorabilia and Tex Avery videos and... I mean, I quite like that idea that sort of you just become a version of who you want to be or an extension of a bigger version of you.
Yeah, I remember, I think I that was part of Jim Carrey's amazing year, wasn't it? He did Ace Ventura. I think Ace Ventura was 93, but I think over the 12 months, he did Ace Ventura, The Mask, and then Dumb and Dumber. And they all came out within 12 months of each other.
At the time as well, I remember it almost seeming weird that, like, it's almost that I'd never heard of him before Ace Ventura. And it was almost like, these other films must have been in production before this came out. And just to have a launch like that, where you've basically got three massive movies that are essentially vehicles for your talent.
Yeah.
Come out one after the other, and for them all to be, like, huge mega hits.
Yeah.
Like, within a year, he was like... I mean, how much later is Cable Guy? Is that 97?
I think Cable Guy was 96. which was originally a vehicle for Chris Farley.
Oh, was it?
And for some reason, he didn't do it. I think they were forcing him into doing Black Sheep, which was the follow-up to Tommy Boy. And so they were like, right, you're doing that instead. And the cable guy was, I think, was a bit dark. Hmm. So then Jim Carrey got it, and he got paid $20 million for that.
$20 million.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, you go, right, so he did three films in a row. And also, you know, Ace Ventura, Courtney Cox was in Ace Ventura, and then Friends started the same year, I think. And so when Friends was being advertised, Courtney Cox pops up, and you go, oh, that's that woman out of Ace Ventura. I had such a massive crush on her in Ace Ventura. So when Friends started, I watched it because Courtney Cox was in it. And I sort of feel like the original series of Friends, the first one, is like a vehicle for Courtney Cox.
I felt like, that way, but probably because, like you say, she was the only one I knew.
Yeah, but it's kind of like it's her flat. Mm. And it's the two guys that live over the road from her, yeah, and her brother, and she's sort of like, and then Rachel is her friend, and yeah, it is the six of them, but it's kind of like she is the thing that holds them all together. And in that first season, before it kind of like found its like legs, there's all like her working in a kitchen, and then she has a different guest star sous chef every week that's kind of like, that's someone off another sitcom, and they're sort of like cross-pollinating all the other sitcoms. I know that in one of the, I don't know if it's the first series, it's probably the first series, I know that Leah Thompson appears in it as Caroline from Caroline in the City, and George Clooney and ER, and I think it was all kind of like, it was all kind of like whatever the Friday night lineup was, and it's just kind of like we're cross-pollinating it with people from different shows, and they sort of did that. But I think, yeah, like, certainly towards the beginning of the season, it was kind of like, this is Courtney Cox, and she works in a restaurant, and this is her colleague that works with her, and they dropped that, like, straight away.
And it's true, like, you had Elliot Gould as a dad, and he was, like, a regular, you know, he wasn't, like, a kind of occasional guest star, he'd be in it.
I mean, that show's crazy, because, like, Bruce, because it's weird, because it felt, at the time, like, it was... I like Friends. I grew up and I love Friends. I watched it every week, and I went around my mate's house to watch it. You know, it was like event TV. And then I was obsessed with it. I watched it all the time, right up until the last episode, and then it stopped, and then I never thought about it ever again.
I love it. But I never got to the end of it. Like, there's definitely a period of Friends where people talk about it, and it's obviously just like, didn't see those ones.
I think, from my memory, the best season was season 9. And that was the one where Paul Rudd came in as Phoebe's boyfriend. Yeah, and he was absolutely incredible. Paul Rudd was amazing in Friends. And then when the 10th season came along, they were all kind of like, right, this is the last season and this is our show. So everyone else, like Paul Rudd, everyone else got sidelined. And it was just like, no, it's about us. And we're not letting anyone else have any of the laughs. It's just us. And you go, fair enough, it's your show. But it was a shame because Paul Rudd was so good in season 9. I really liked it. Oh, yeah, but so it's stuff like Bruce Willis came in and played sort of Rachel's boyfriend. And he was in like 3 episodes and he got an Emmy for it. Like, for just turning up and doing 3, and it's kind of like, this is sort of like Saved by the Bell, only a little bit more sophisticated, but it's not much more sophisticated. At its worst, it was on a par even, and then at its best, it was actually quite, you know, it was quite good. But
I remember it though, like, almost, I think now it's one of those things that's very fondly remembered. I remember at the time being one of those things where it wasn't seen as cool at all, and people would be quite snidey about it, and I remember going, no, it's better than what you think it is. It's a much better written sitcom than people who are quite snide about it.
That was what I always said. I always said I just think the writing's really good. Like, not always, like, but I think that season 9 was such a strong season, and I think season 2 was a strong season, and then season 3 wasn't quite as good, and then it would flip like that. Like, there'd be a really good one, and then there'd be kind of like, one not as good, but the writing was always good. And also the cast was incredible. And I think those people, they're obviously set for life because those people are so beloved by like an entire generation of people that, you know, murder mystery, like Adam Sandler made a murder mystery for Netflix and it's the most watched film that Netflix have ever made. And it's not 100% because of Adam Sandler. It's like people love Jennifer Aniston. And yeah, it was a really good cast. And I just think, and I would, hand on heart, just think that David Schwimmer's kind of like the best of the bunch. I think he's absolutely incredible because he could do everything. He could do like the romantic stuff. He could do the heavy lifting. He could do the dramatic stuff. He could do physical comedy. I mean, he was brilliant, right? Some of the seasons when he was like having a breakdown and stuff were sort of like they pushed the limit of believability. But when it all clicked, like, yeah, it was brilliant. It was a great show. But anyway, so Ace Ventura, Dumb and Dumber of the Mask. The last time I saw The Mask, I think, maybe 20 years ago.
Me too, exactly the same.
And I remember it because the gangster plot line is serious.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? It's like it's because it's a PG, so it's sort of toothless at the same time. But they don't play it for like laughs. It's kind of like, yeah, these are proper. This is like a straight movie.
There's a couple of nice bits of it that are just sort of quite surprisingly well done and sort of like rug pulls, like where it introduces the kind of, you know, you've got Cameron Diaz is introduced as kind of like the bad girl who's like the gangster's mole. And then halfway through, you're introduced to the good girl, who's the one like, oh, right, that's who it'll end up with. And it doesn't end up the way you would imagine it would.
Yeah.
And that's quite a nice rug pull for a movie that's quite straightforward and quite... And I'd forgotten about that entirely. I was like, you know, I just sort of assume the plot line would go exactly how they're setting it up to make you think it's going to go.
Yeah.
And it is. It's just like... But it does. It's like... It's better than it needs to be, partly because Jim Carrey sort of knew and obviously hungry and is really putting a lot into it. The aesthetic of it really works still and doesn't look dated, even though like you can tell like it's not made on a huge budget, but it's still like because it's made that choice early on that it's going to have a style to it. It looks better than a lot of things from that era. Especially comedy films, you know, they sort of feel like they're very much in their era.
But that's sort of what I mean about it in terms of the comedy. It's kind of like it's a straight film that's got a comedic performance in it.
Okay. You know?
But he's like even at the beginning before he's the mask and he's fucking around in the bank and he's pretending like his tie is his tongue. All of that stuff. You go, yeah, all right. He's sort of like being... I just find it tonally a bit weird where it's kind of like... It's not as funny as you think it is because there's so much straight stuff in it.
Hmm.
And then, I don't know. I remember I really liked it at the cinema and I remember when I watched it on video, I was just sort of like, okay, it's not as funny as I remember it and all that. But do you know what? I'm not going to be a dick about it.
It's not something that's a great, great movie, but there's lots of things about it which are good and were smart at the time that feel like it stood the test of time better than I might have imagined it would.
I think it was probably my favourite of the three.
Mm.
Like, so what? He would have done those three, then he would have done Batman Forever, then he would have done The Cable Guy. Yeah. But
it's remarkable that from those three films, but to have within a year... three massive hits that at the end of it you are now, you know, you're one of the highest paid people in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Equal highest, right, at the time.
And they would have been making them independently of each other without realizing that he was a huge megastar when he was making them, you know.
Yeah. And it's like when The Mask came out, the producers must have been going absolutely brilliant because now he's the big star off of Ace Ventura and yeah. That kind of rolled on to Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah. And also, I just remember it's got one of my favourite jokes in it where he's in prison and he gets the dog Milo and he's like going, get the keys. And then Milo gets like some cheese and he goes, not the cheese, the keys. And it's like, it's asking you to believe that the dog has got the same kind of names for the stuff that we call stuff, and he's misheard keys for cheese. But I just think it's really sweet. I think it's really funny. Let's play a song and then we'll talk some more.
FUBAR Radio.
And we're back in the barracks. So the boys are back in the barracks. Partridge. So, what else have you seen this week, Nathaniel?
Gosh, what have I seen? I have seen The Five Bloods.
Oh, yeah, because Chadwick Boseman died this
week. Yeah, I fancied watching something with him in. And that had been on my Netflix list since it came out. And it's all right. It's not an amazing film by any means. But what you do get from it is it's such a film that, like, as you're watching it, the aspect ratio is changing and chopping as you're watching it. And you think it's obviously made for the cinema, but he's someone who presumably has to go to Netflix now to get funding. And so there's this thing that's obviously meant to be a kind of...
Spike Lee, right?
Yeah, Spike Lee. And you just get the impression while watching it, like, this isn't how you're meant to watch this at all. And it felt like, you know, if this was the kind of thing they were doing odd screenings at somewhere, or, you know, maybe it's just because of lockdown, maybe that was meant to happen. But when you're watching it, it's like, I'm not watching the film. And he sort of, my brain kind of checked out at that point when he kind of realised whatever's meant to be happening, whatever you're meant to be getting from this, you're not, because it's obviously telling you things in its...
Do you think they released it on Netflix because of COVID?
Yeah, I mean, it's a Netflix-made thing. I'm sure he's right. Given up the idea of... I think it's like Scorsese, you know, trying to get The Irishman made, and eventually Netflix put the money for it. But in Martin Scorsese's mind, he's got print of it that he can play in his...
But I don't understand the aspect ratio thing, because the Transformers film... I don't watch Transformers films, but I watch something about the Transformers films. I won't watch the films, but I will watch someone on YouTube talking about the films. And they were talking about the aspect ratio, and that changes within the same scene. Within, like, from in a dialogue scene, from shot to shot, the aspect ratio will change, where it's so distracting that it just gives... It's just an extra element of the Transformers movies that gives you another migraine, you know. And I don't quite understand. I know Christopher Nolan does it a lot, because he, with Dark Knight, he was flipping in between IMAX and, just regular cinema screens.
One of the Mission Impossibles does that. I think it's the fourth one. I went to see it in IMAX, and that's like some bits suddenly go full length.
Is that the Brad Bird one?
Yes, it's that one.
Is that the one when he goes to Dubai and he's on the building?
I think it is that one, yeah.
I think there was bits of that were filmed for IMAX. Because it was just like the tallest building in the world, wasn't it? And he's on the side of it. God. I mean, we've definitely talked about it. It's just like Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg and Tom Cruise all in a hotel room in the world's tallest building. Well, one of us has got to go out there. And then Pegg and Ving Rhames look at Tom Cruise, and Tom Cruise just goes, "Oh, no. Oh no, not me, not me, oh no, ah!" And the next thing you know, he's hanging off the side of the building, and you go, "You fucking produced it, mate. It's just the most fucking..." It's so weak.
But it would be funnier if it cut to Ving Rhames.
Yeah, exactly.
Bless him, he's great, I love him. I genuinely think he's great in everything, except that last Mission Impossible film is like cuts of him like, where he's not even running. As the others start running and he's running with them, it sort of cuts. He sort of enters the side of stage like, "Yeah, I'm here as well." And it's like, you can't even see him running in films.
Oh, well. I like that Mission Impossible film. But yeah, sure, so The Five Bloods. It's definitely on my list. It had huge reviews, and especially because Chadwick Boseman died. I mean, it's weird, isn't it? Because it's awful, awful news. But I'm not a Marvel fan. So it's this happens every time someone famous dies, is that their picture will be on Twitter and Facebook, and I scroll past it because I will just assume that they're making some sort of announcement about a project that they're doing, and then someone will say something, you know, 6 hours later, and then the penny will drop, and I'll be like, "Oh God!" And that's what happened with that. I was like scrolling by, and at no point did I kind of like just automatically assume that because there were all these photos of him everywhere that it died. And then you know, It was really sad, really sad. But yeah, and I wanted to sort of like watch something this week with him in. But and I like Spike Lee as well.
It's quite an interesting one because it's his appearance in it. He's very much a supporting character, and in fact, it's not spoiling anything. His character, it's all people with Vietnam who were there when they were young.
And so what is it, like a heist film?
Sort of, yeah. Yeah, they are looking for they're looking for gold in Vietnam. So they're ex-Vietnam soldiers who go back, and Chadwick Boseman only appears in flashback because his character dies in Nam. So you kind of know he's dead at the beginning.
Right.
So going into it is also quite a weird thing to watch when you go, oh yeah, he has just died. Watching a film where he's referenced all the time as being this, even within the film, he's this like icon of someone who died young, and they've all grown up and got older, and they're going back to where they were all together.
Yeah. So I watched something that sounds like it's quite similar to The Five Bloods this week.
What did you watch this week?
I watched Peter's Friends, which is about, you know, a young group of friends that that go through the trenches of of musical review theatre, and then meet up 10 years later, only to find out one of their spoiler alert friends is dying. Fucking hell!
One of the worst films you've ever seen in your life.
I think it's the worst film I've ever seen. I think it is.
It might be. It's up there.
It's. Do you know what? The person that comes out of it the best is Tony Slattery. But he's got sort of like a thankless role. But every single character is an absolute cunt. And every single person that's acting is throwing in a performance from their own imagined production. It's like none of the performances match each other. They're all kind of, Emma Thompson is good, but her character is annoying.
Like at the time, when it came out, I remember going, oh, I love all these guys from thing. When I saw it, it made me think, well, is this what you're all really like? Because I don't like any of you anymore.
It was I think it's the worst film. But someone tweeted me about Sliding Doors. And I think Sliding Doors is not the worst film ever made. I think Sliding Doors has it's so on the nose the way they set it up, but it's got an interesting premise. Do you know what I mean? They haven't done like that magical realism thing like Groundhog Day does, where there's this thing that's happened and it's unexplained. They literally have made two films with different scenarios happening in them. So it's a nice idea for a thing. What if you just do one thing different and it changes your whole thing? It changes your whole life.
A good, like, people refer to Sliding Doors as being a thing where two different, your life can go in two different directions. So it's like entered the kind of national consciousness, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think as a setup for a film, it's a nice idea. And I think Gwyneth Paltrow, I was just thinking, Gwyneth Paltrow's got like a terrible reputation for herself. But you just think about all of the films she's in. And I just like all of the films. Yeah, I think she's great in Seven. I think she's great in Great Expectations. Did you ever see Great Expectations?
No.
It was Ethan Hawke. It was like a modernised American remake. Ethan Hawke, Gwyneth Paltrow and Robert De Niro. And I just remember seeing it at the cinema when it came out. I think my mum and my sister were going to the cinema and I just tagged along. And I didn't like have a say in what we were watching, just went to see it. And it's just beautiful. I think it's directed by the same person that directed A Little Princess. Did you see that?
No.
That film, right? Consider it's called, it's either called The Little Princess or A Little Princess. That film, considering it is pretty much, it was like a Warner Brothers thing, like Secret Garden, and it was sort of made for little girls. That film is fucking incredible, right? If you've got kids You should definitely watch The Little Princess. It's just a beautiful, stunning film. It's just great. And I think the person that did that went on to do Great Expectations, and that film was great. Gwyneth Paltrow was great, mate. And this week, I watched The Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, I think that that is my favourite film of all time. I sort of, like, hesitate a little bit because I don't want to be kind of like one of them hipsters that just loves everything that Wes Anderson does. But I just think Royal Tenenbaums is absolutely incredible. It's, I think, and I watched Bottle Rocket as well. So I watched Bottle Rocket, which was Wes Anderson's first film. And that's really funny, and it's so well observed. And Owen Wilson wrote it with Wes Anderson. And he wrote those first three. So he wrote Bottle Rocket, and then he wrote Rushmore, and then he wrote Royal Tenenbaums. And then he had a bit of a wobble, and Wes Anderson wrote Life Aquatic with Noah Baumbach, was it?
Yes.
And which is confusing because I think Noah Taylor's in it. So I get confused between the Noahs.
Life Aquatic's my favourite.
I think that it's like, it's, see, I can't stand Darjeeling Limited. And I've never got all the way through Fantastic Mr. Fox. I liked Grand Budapest Hotel, and I'd probably say it was my second favourite. No, Bottle Rocket's incredible. I've never really loved Rushmore. I think it's good, but it's not. Or it's not the film. I think that the thing about Life Aquatic is like it stars Owen Wilson, and I love Owen Wilson, and it stars Owen Wilson, and he's in it, but I just feel like it, the film lacks the heart that he brings to stuff like Royal Tenenbaums. And I got to say that I just think Luke Wilson is just one of the best actors. I think he's incredible.
I think he's tremendous. It's interesting, though, because I think part of what I like about Life Aquatic is Owen Wilson and how much I am involved in his story. I'm totally, totally sold on it. So it's interesting. Yeah.
I never felt like I could. I know he's meant to be distant, and he's meant to sort of like be suffering from like a depression, and so he's sort of like, it sort of fits the thing. It fits the film, but Luke Wilson in The Royal Tenenbaums. I mean, it just had me crying all the way through it. I just thought the bit went, oh God, I just you know the bit.
I know the bit,
and. I've had a tough time the last few years, and I haven't seen it. So when it came out, it came out in 2001, and I saw it in February 2001 at the Screen Cinema in Winchester, and it was the second best independent cinema in the country, and I think it was like a Saturday night. I saw Royal Tenenbaums by myself. I came back and I was just buzzing about it. I came back to our shared house, and I was just like, just going on and on about it. And then the next day, my friend was really into Lord of the Rings, and we watched Fellowship of the Ring, which was 3.5 hours long or however long. And then we left, and I was just like, yeah, it's fine. But I bought a ticket straight away to go and see Royal Tenenbaums. So even though I'd just been sat down for like three and a half hours, I just went straight back in again to watch Tenenbaums. And yeah, I loved it. And then I went back to see it on the Monday, but they weren't showing it anymore because they'd brought it out for a limited time. So it was BAFTA eligible. So I must've been 20 when I first saw it. And, I'm 40 soon. I've had that amount of time since the first time I saw it to now, and I'm watching it again on the other side. You know, they all those guys were in their 30s when they made it, I was 20, and I'm looking up to like this is what the future is, and now I'm almost 40, and I'm looking back, and I'm like saying, well, I've gone through that part of my life. And it's sort of like, it's the sort of film that has resonated differently with me And I watched Army of Darkness 100 times, and I've ruined it for myself, right? I will always love Army of Darkness, but I can't watch it with the same enthusiasm. Whereas I drip feed myself all 10 times because I don't want to ruin it. And there's always something new to notice in it. And I've been watching like Gene Hackman stuff recently because, I watched No Way Out with Gene Hackman in it. And I think that, and then I watched Runaway Jury, which I think is actually one of the worst made films I've ever seen.
For a time, I was going to see anything. It's funny that Gene Hackman is one of those actors who has just retired.
He retired in 2004. And now he writes westerns. He writes cowboy books.
Oh, that's quite fun.
And historic novels. So he's still around, but but he's retired, yeah. But he retired like 16 years ago.
Yeah. And I think there was a, like, whatever it was around that time, I remember going, God, I love Gene Hackman. I'm going to watch every Gene Hackman film. And then did. And there was only a few more. And it just finished. And you, amongst those, you would see some quite bad movies. But he was always terrific in them. He's like, he's so good in everything.
Yeah, he's brilliant. You know, really difficult person to work with by all accounts. But, I mean, he's really good. Have you ever seen the film Scarecrow?
No, I don't know it at all.
No, I'd never heard of it until last week. It's Gene Hackman and Al Pacino. And they're sort of like hobos that go cross country together. And it was made in 1973 in between The Godfathers. And it's really fucking depressing, but it's a really good film. Anyway, we're going to do fan mail. So if you don't mind, Brian.
All right, mate, how's it going? Right, here's your fan mail this week. Films are better than the book. Short stories tend to work better as films, such as Brokeback Mountain, AI, Shawshank Redemption, The Birds, Minority Report, and The Fly.
And is Running Man a short film? It's part of the Richard Bachman short stories that Stephen King wrote under his pen name Richard Bachman. Is Running Man?
I think Running Man does count as one of his shorts, actually. Yeah, I think you're right there, Nick. Well done for bringing that up. I was wondering if Nick's sleep finally got better. I found when I quit booze, it took 4 weeks to sleep normally. Thanks for the podcast and for introducing me to Deep Red and Tommy Boy Matthew. That's the fucking show! Yes! Finally, somebody watched something that we talked about. Brilliant. Deep Red, happy birthday. That's my fucking gift to you, you fucking legend. And it was Nathaniel's gift to me. Absolutely wonderful. And Tommy Boy, yeah, fucking hell. That's maybe my... That and Ten and Bumps. Hi, guys. I watched something the other day that I think is right up your street. It's called Live from the Space Stage. It's a documentary about Halex Brown's Helix.
Brown's Helix?
Oh, pardon me there, Christopher. It's a documentary about Halex.
Brown's Helix?
Unbelievable that you missed your cue. Who were a Star Wars inspired rock group who performed at Disneyland during the 80s? It's available to watch on YouTube for free. Love the show, Barry Hines. Do you know what, Barry? I'll certainly be checking that out.
Oh, I will actually as well, Barry. Yeah, sounds great. I'd love to hear your opinion on it, Brian.
Oh, I'd love to give it. Hey, Nick and Matt. Hey, Nick and Nate. I am 22. I have always had access to the internet. Do you guys have a first memory of being on a computer? Did you have memes back then, Tyler?
Yeah, I remember the first time I went and used the internet. It's mental.
But even the idea of I was on computers, Tyler, before the internet was on them.
Yeah, I've always had had a computer. I used to load up stuff on my Spectrum ZX.
ZX Spectrum.
I think I had a He-Man Master of the Universe game and a Ghostbusters game and Hunchback of Notre Dame.
It'd take about 10 minutes to load, wouldn't it?
10 minutes to load. But the first time I went on the internet, I went on Ask Jeeves, and I asked Jeeves about Bruce Campbell, and I printed out his entire filmography. That's what I did.
Okay. Hi, guys. It's September. You know what that means? Christmas is coming. Is there anything you'd like? Are you working on your list, Rich?
No, I've got everything. I've got more than I need. I'd like world peace. How about you, Nathaniel?
I'd like an end to all this COVID.
I'd like an end to this COVID, too. And I'd like people to start being nice to each other again. I like the beginning of lockdown.
And also, I like the look of some of these box sets that are coming out, probably. I'll have a couple of them as well.
Maybe I'll get another hardback book about RoboCop that I'll never read.
Yeah.
What's up, guys? Just wondering if you had a favourite sauce or a ketchup.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of ketchup. I'm a big fan of holy fuck sauce. My God, it's hot, but it's the most delicious fucking sauce ever. If you can buy it online. It's brilliant.
Hi, guys. You know what I don't get about The Mandalorian? Why bother casting such a handsome lead in Pedro Pascal if he's just going to be wearing a helmet all the time? Natasha, P.S., for the love of God, get him on the show.
Well, we'll do our very best. We'll certainly try. But also, it'll never happen. But also, that is that sort of thinking, yeah, that leads to mistakes happening with Judge Dredd. Okay, so just be careful what you wish for. All right. Okay, but although the Mandalorian wasn't a pre-existing character, so, you know, he could have taken his helmet off and no one would have been upset about it. I've not watched the Mandalorian yet. I've heard it's good, but my heart aches every time I think about Star Wars.
Hi, guys! People in London always make fun of me when I recount a childhood memory of the man in the fruit farm handing me a satsuma or a tomato as a free treat. Is this weird? Is this an exclusive West Country thing, Bill? How many people in London laugh at you when you talk about a man giving you a free satsuma?
Imagine it's quite a nice memory.
I don't know why people are laughing at you, but I also I don't buy it, and I don't think it's a London thing. Look, you just have your. You know what I find weird? Somebody giving you a tomato. I can understand a free satsuma.
Sure.
But giving someone like a free tomato, I find that weird. But, you know, that's just me. Have we done all the fan mail?
Yeah.
Well, let's play a song then and get a guest on.
The hand that wrote this letter sweeps the pillow clean. So rest your head and read a treasured dream. I care for no one else but you. I tear my soul to cease the pain. I think maybe you feel the same. What can we do? Quite sure what we're supposed to do. So I've been writing just for you. They say your life is going very well. They say you sparkle like a different girl. But something tells me that you hide. When all the world is warm and tired, you cry a little in the dark. Well, so do I. I'm not quite sure what you're supposed to say, but I can see it's not okay. He makes you laugh, he brings you out in style. He treats you well and makes you up real fine. And when he's strong for you. And when you kiss, it's something new. But did you ever call my name just by mistake? I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to do. So I'll just write some love to you.
Nick and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Okay. We're back in the studio. We're not in the studio. I'm in my living room. And Nat's in his living room. Welcome back to Camp COVID. We've joined in the studio, not in the studio, live, not live, it's pre-recorded. We're joined now by Stu Whiffen. Hello, Stu, how you doing?
I'm good. It's a pleasure to be here. How are you? You all right?
Yeah, really good, thank you. I had the pleasure of doing your podcast, Off the Beaten Track. When was it? Was it this year?
It was, beginning of the year. I reckon February. Well, I reckon it was probably like January.
Yeah, right. It was a lovely podcast.
Little did you know what was going to happen the year ahead.
Hey?
You were so wide-eyed and innocent back then. But yeah, that's I love doing your podcasts, and so thanks for having me on that.
It was an absolute pleasure. I got to kind of it's really weird when you start talking about records that really sort of matter to people. You kind of get a real measure of them. It's quite interesting, you know. And yeah, we went in on some great records. It was it was a good natter, mate.
And we also found out that did you used to run the Pink Toothbrush in Southend?
I still do.
You still do? Right, yeah. So my mate Ollie, you know Ollie?
Yeah.
Yeah. So my mate Ollie used to sort of like, I don't know, did he DJ there?
He might have DJed like once or twice there, but we had another little night in Southend that we used to sort of work. It was me, him, and another guy that we know, a stand-up kind of musician type character, and the three of us put a night on together in Southend.
Who was that?
That's I don't even know if I'm allowed to swear on here.
I'm in the game.
Yeah, cunt in the game. Yeah,
you're allowed to swear. Fucking, so that was Wayne, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh well, I was gonna bring up cunt in the gang next, actually. Yeah. how would you describe cunt in the gang?
How would I describe them? A one man kind of. Imagine if you kind of sat, so, kind of plinky plonky 80s synth pop behind stories from Viz. I think.
That's
would high, and throw a bit of Carry On in there, and I think you're pretty much there.
Yeah, okay, that's probably the best way. I've never thought about it in terms of Viz, but as soon as you say Viz, it gives it like a context which is actually quite accessible.
Yeah.
Acceptable. Yeah. Like, you go, oh yeah, it's like Viz. Oh yeah, it's fine. Because I had a friend, my best friend John, I was best man at his wedding, and his wife Megan. And we all went on holiday, and I made everyone listen to Cunt and the Gang. And we all had a real great time listening to Cunt and the Gang on holiday. And then when we got back, she had a dinner party, and there was like a lull in conversation. And she was just like, I'll play some Cunt and the Gang. And she did, and they don't talk to her anymore. they were so offended by it. And you kind of like go, it is a gamble, isn't it? It's kind of like you go, are they ready to listen to it? It's Cunt with a K, like Cool and the Gang.
Yeah.
But it's just
I think you might have taken me. The whole bunch of us went on Edinburgh to see them in like a small room, in one of the small rooms. And I remember there was like a warning that was like, you might like this or you might hate it. And I was being a bit like, I've no idea. And I loved it. And I sort of got annoyed that people go, why wouldn't I like this?
It's really weird that you mentioned Cool and the Gang, because for a while, if you went to the official Cool and the Gang website, there was like a little addendum on the homepage that it wasn't Cunt and the Gang, which I thought, you've kind of made it then.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah.
Cool and the Gang, they've become the main draw.
Well, I remember in 2010 when I had my first like good year in Edinburgh. I knew I'd made it because Daniel Kitson came on the same day as my drama teacher and Cunt and the Gang. And I was on stage and I was going, that's my drama teacher who thought I was shit. That's Daniel Kitson and that's Cunt and the Gang. And I just thought, fucking hell, what an audience. it's like the full gamut. Say again.
That wasn't the whole audience though.
It wasn't busy. It was like, it was near the beginning of the month. So it was just like, oh, but you know you've made it when Kitson and Cunt both turn up on the same day. So you still run the Pink Toothbrush. How's that?
It's been pretty quiet for the last sort of 5 months, really, Nick. Mm-hmm. And it's just weird, mate. It's, you know, we've just started to kind of consider the concept of maybe putting on some stand-up or maybe putting on some live podcast that we can do sort of socially distanced, seated. But we don't own seats, you know. You've been in there. It's a dirty, smelly indie rock club. But it's got a gigantic stage in there. And yeah, it's just strange. We can't open it as a club at the moment, which is such a shame. But, you know, as soon as we're told it's safe and sound, we can, you know, we will reopen. But I think all the time there's restrictions in place, you know, without getting too sort of boring about it, we're just worried that we're going to get sued. Someone's going to come in and catch something. And then, you know, before you know it, we're being sued by someone. So it's like, right, let's look at what we can do. But, you know, in regards to, you know, playing rock and roll music, you know, turned up to 10 for loads of sweaty indie kids, I can't see that happening this year, mate.
Not at all this year.
I don't know. I mean, obviously, you know, as a stand-up, you've obviously seen a very similar sort of thing as well. Do you know what I mean? It's like no one's... I mean, you know, I'm seeing now some stand-ups starting to happen again. I'm seeing people in, like, pub gardens and stuff and stuff like that happening. But, yeah, I've not seen, like, anything that makes me think a nightclub's going to reopen and, you know, people are going to go crazy again.
No, and I also feel like these are tentative steps that people are taking in preparation for just being shut down again.
Yeah.
I feel like if anything that does happen this year, it's not going to be permanent. And it's just, I don't know, it's weird, isn't it? It's just such a weird time because it's difficult to even know what we're meant to be doing just kind of like on a daily basis now. It's kind of like when it was lockdown, or you're all locked down, you're all staying in. It's like, good, I know where I am there. I can deal with that, right? I'm not leaving the house. But now it's kind of like you look around and people do not give a fuck. It's just kind of like you go, well, what are we doing then?
Yeah,
I don't get it. But that's all the COVID stuff. But, you know,
Are you Southend born and bred, Stu?
No, I don't actually live in Southend. I live kind of, I live in a place called Grays, which kind of is quite grey and miserable. And yeah, it's kind of, I'd say probably in between London and Southend. And yeah, I've actually lived there all my life. It's kind of, it's close enough to London, but annoyingly far enough away that the last train home's still like 11:30. You know, right. you can't really go out and enjoy yourself in London anymore. You still got to get that kind of last train home. So,
yeah. I get that about lots of towns. I think Southend and sort of like that kind of part of Essex has that a lot, where people kind of create their own things in those areas. And there's a few, like, and doing stand-up, you go to various different towns and some feel like they've got a real sort of scene of things going on and people that, and it tends to be like from grassroots, like small bands that put on shows themselves or find these venues that they can put shows on. And I get that, yeah, like Southend and sort of parts of Essex have these like clubs you play where it feels like there is a grassroots thing, whereas other towns in the UK are almost, you get off the train and you're on the high street and they all look the same. But there's certain towns and places that have something going on. And I think that comes from that, right? There's certain places that seem to have people in it that create their own stuff or want to create their own stuff. And I wonder if that's because you're so close to London, but you can't stay out late, that you want that in your town.
Probably. You're probably right. And bizarrely, I set my podcast up to ask that very question. That the podcast that Nick guested on was initially sort of set up and it being called Off the Beaten Track. Like, I was just fascinated by a conversation I'll be Scroobius Pip, who lives sort of 5 minutes from Grays in a place called Stamford Le Hope, how he'd never moved to London because it's the done thing when you're an aspiring actor, comedian, musician that you move to London. And he was like, oh, nah, I didn't really fancy that. Whereas I look at the other acts from that come out at the same time as Pip in Southend, like The Horrors and These New Puritans and Get Kate, Where Kate Fly, they all moved to London. And I just found that really interesting, why there was that kind of, why you felt like you couldn't do it in your own hometown. And that's what kind of led me to want to know about how your hometown kind of defines you and how it, you know, can limit creativity or it can, you know, open up creativity. And I think what you just said, Nathaniel, is that I think sometimes people just think, oh, if I can't get the last train home, I'm just going to create something. And them aforementioned bands, these New Puritans, the Horrors, there was a band called Ipso Facto that come out of that scene. They created this thing called Junk Club at the venue where me and our friend Ollie put a night on. And they just created this amazing night that just made no sense. It was really like everybody looked like kind of theatrical, kind of, it was really gothy, it was really dark, and they were playing like post-punk. But it was just really crazy and it made no sense. But it just created this amazing scene and just pushed all of these bands out of it that have then gone on to create some amazing things. So I do think there's little kind of towns on the peripheries of London that does create that kind of scene, 100%.
Because also I think here, when you were talking about you're like a indie DJ, but I don't think you really get those clubs in London. I've sort of lived in London all my life, but it feels like when people talk about themselves growing up and they've got these little clubs that they go to, which plays the music that they like, and it's not things outside the mainstream. It's almost like London doesn't really have that because it's too big. And it's like, it's almost, it's got no, it hasn't got the focus. So it doesn't have its own small venue where it has an alternative, like you can play alternative music or something, because it's sort of too big. It's sort of too disparate. And I think this can happen in smaller towns in a way that's easier to happen than it would be in a huge city like London.
Definitely. But I also think in general, like your indie and your rock clubs, they're disappearing. Like, you know, that them, there seemed to be like indie nights everywhere when I was growing up. And you know, I don't know if that was the case in your student days and or clubbing years. Like, they just seem to be loads. And now it's really weird. I might have even sort of touched on this when Nick came on the podcast, that there used to be quite, you could see, like, youth cultures will wear their colours on their sleeves. You could see the indie kid, you know, you could see the goth, you know, you could see the grunge kids, and you can't really see that anymore. There's kind of like this uniform Topshop window now where everybody likes a bit of everything, aside from metalers. Metalers are still diehard. They wear their colours. But it does feel like everybody just kind of, maybe that's to do with streaming and the accessibility of music now, like where everyone, oh yeah, I like that, that's all right, I like a bit of that, where it feels, I hope it's just because I'm 47 and so out of touch, it feels like it's not that tribal anymore.
No, it doesn't. I'm sure, yeah, a sort of part of me thinks it must be, and maybe it's right that I'm 41, maybe it's right I don't know about it. Yeah. I'll find out about it when there's a documentary in 10 years time. And I'll go, all right, okay. I had no idea that happened. And so
I'm 39, so I'm kind of like got my finger a little bit more on the pulse than you.
Right, yeah.
And I haven't really noticed that much. I did notice that there was, like, you know, being in London, I did always sort of like feel, where's my pub? You know, where's the place that I go that plays the sort of music I like? And then there are sort of like, there are sort of places that I found. There was like, I used to really love going to Slim Jim's on Upper Street, which just played sort of like proper like rock music, but like not modern rock music. It was kind of like 70s and 80s stuff, and I really loved that. And there was another place on Holloway Road called Big Red, which was sort of like a more commercial version of Slim Jim's. And then Slim Jim's is like a sister of Aces and Eights, which is walking distance anyway. So there were places that I eventually found that I felt like, oh, this is where I feel I belong. But then you sort of like feel like you can never get a table in those places because people are there ironically, and it's kind of a bit touristy, and it's kind of like you go, oh, sure, but this is actually what my point is, like, for me to go into a pub where they play Alice Cooper just because that's what they're playing, and it's not Poison. Do you know what I mean? You kind of like go, oh, right, well, this is my sort of venue. But it took me ages to sort of like find somewhere that I felt was sort of like represented me, because, you know, you normally know O'Neill's when we were growing up, and they'd play like, you know, Venger Boys and Steps, and it'd be like, just, oh God, this isn't for me.
I always wanted to find a pub that, music aside, I always just wanted that pub, like in Cheers, like where you could walk in on your own and like and you'd be all right. I've never had that. I've never gone in a pub on my own and like and had a conversation with the barman and like and then struck up a random conversation with someone else at a stall.
Oh, really? Because yeah. I used to work in pubs, and that's exactly the sort of environment that we had. And you'd see people that were, you'd see people that were walking down the street towards the pub, and they'd be like Carlsberg top, and so you'd get it ready for them, so that when they got in, you'd just put it on the side, and they'd say, "Oh, thank you very much." I was in one pub called the Glass House, which was kind of like it was just sort of a weird sports bar, but they liked me because they always used to play rugby and I never used to watch it because I don't like sport. So I could work throughout all of the... There'd be the other bar staff would be watching the game and yeah. I'd be there doing like, 8 Guinnesses, there you go. So I think they liked me there. But yeah, I always sort of like got to know the staff. And I really loved that as like a place of community. It was sort of like a double-edged because, you know... I loved seeing them and I loved getting their drinks ready and, you know, making them feel special. Like, oh, you remembered my drink, you know. But, well, on the flip side of that is he came in every fucking day and it was a bit bleak.
Yeah.
The flip side of that is the bloke who comes in with his Carlsberg top and he's too nervous to say, I only wanted it once. I just wanted it. It was just sunny out that day. I went to the Carlsberg top because I was quite thirsty and I wanted something a bit easy.
Yeah.
I have to have it every day whenever I go to the pub. And the guy's always poured it for me. And all I want's a Guinness, but I can't ask for a Guinness because he's poured it for me.
When I was little, we went around my grandma's house and she made a roast chicken. And one of the nicest things in the world is like crispy chicken skin when it's hot. Mm-mm. And I was like, oh, I love chicken skin. And then the next day when it was cold, they like put me like a plate of cold chicken skin. And you have to go, well, not like this, obviously. This is, but you know, you're too young. So you end up just having to eat a plate cold chicken skin. Yeah, maybe I should have been a bit more thoughtful towards it. You're right, Nathaniel. I realise in hindsight, I've been a massive cunt. I'm sorry. You're in your own pub, though, Stu.
I am. See, this is it. If I want a Carlsberg top, I can be. It's not the same, though. Honestly, like, since lockdown and the pub's all shut, like, it's... You'd think it'd be great. It was like, well, I could just go down my own pub and have a pint, but it's no fun, is it, sitting on your own having a pint?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And it's not always a pint of beer. One of the things, I went out the other day for lockdown. I went out the other day, we sat in a pub garden and, they kept getting our table mixed up with another table. And every time we ordered a drink, it would take half an hour. And eventually they brought us the bill and it was like 280 quid and it's just like, what? And then there was a bunch of stuff on there that we didn't order and then everyone was like chipping in and sort of like, and I was just like, no, it's fine, I'll just say that we've got the wrong bill, right? And everyone else started like arguing and they were like going, oh, it says here I've had 9 pints but I've only had 7, and it's just kind of like, you're not making it sound better. You know what I mean? Just shut up, all right? And then I was just thinking, oh, it's so much nicer when you're on your own in your flat. And you can just serve yourself, it's brilliant. But you've built a pub in your shed at the bottom of your garden, right?
Well, I mean, I didn't build it because I can't build stuff. I'm not that guy, you know. But what this was...
A brick backdrop, so we assume you've got your hod out. And you've got all your bricks out and you've actually built, but all it is just wallpaper, brick wallpaper.
$2.99 a row out of range. And this was a workshop. What the fuck am I going to do in a workshop? It's like, I wouldn't know where to start. It's like, it was just a complete waste of time. So I just thought, right, what can I do here? And I just always liked the pun, having something called the whiff in. And so I was like, right, well, I'm just going to put a little bar in here. And yeah, and it's actually like, it's nice. I kind of recorded lots of podcasts and stuff in here, and it's literally then turned into an office for the last 5 months. So yeah, it's all right. But yeah, it's nice. It's nice to have people over. And fundamentally, I don't have to listen to anyone else's music. I can control the music. I haven't got to get a cab home. And I also don't have to have any pricks in here. So it's quite nice. I can kind of police my own bar, soundtrack it, and walk home.
Is that a polite way of you telling me and Nathaniel that we're not invited?
You boys are welcome whenever, of course.
Sure.
It looks like you're such a professional at the podcasting that you've kind of created this little studio. You've got your brick backdrop, you've got your mic in front of you, and it makes me and Nick feel a bit like we're not really putting the hours in here.
Well, if I was to break down the backgrounds that I'm looking at, Nathaniel, yours not saying too much, really. A door and a wall. Nick's, I mean, I'm fascinated. Like, there is a whole world of stuff that I'd love to have a little nose through there. There looks like there's some amazing stuff there.
Yes, I'm a hoarder.
Yeah.
I'm a very organised hoarder. But, yeah.
I'm more carefully angled. But,
sure. But, yeah, mine is a room where if I tidy it, it looks perfect. And if I put one thing out of place, the whole place looks like a shithole. So it's like, it takes a lot of maintenance. And it's actually, I've built myself a prison. I've got so much stuff that my stuff owns me. And that's what everyone always comes, anyone that always comes over, they go, fucking hell, you've got a lot of stuff. And it's like, it's not a compliment. It's basically a mental disorder that's on your walls. It's difficult, but it's fine.
Stuff's great though, isn't it? I love stuff.
I do love stuff. You've bought some stuff with you, in fact.
I have bought some stuff. I've got a room behind here that's full of my stuff. Like, yeah. I have these kind of arguments with my wife where she's like, why are you buying records? Haven't you got enough? And it's like, we don't work like that. You know, it's not like I've now got X amount of records I don't need anymore. It's like, I like records, so I'm going to buy some more. And it's like, I like books. I like, you know, and so it's like, I like weird little toys and stuff. And it's like, if you can have them, they're nice to look at as well.
Yeah. I mean, it gets worse. I've got another one on the other side. Fucking, for the listeners at home, I have two ornamental cowgirls either side of my desktop. Right. There you go. So we never normally get around to this, but seeing as you've made the effort, I think we should dig into it. So this show is called, for all long-time listeners, maybe we should remind you that the whole point of the show is that we get people on to talk about what they're a fan of. I don't think we've done that in maybe 80 episodes.
No.
It's our 102nd episode. Yeah.
Sometimes at the end we remember that we were meant to do a show, but usually it just ends up in chat. But let's do this. Let's do a proper show and tell.
Okay.
So what have you bought? You've bought a record, you've bought a book, and you've bought a film.
VHS video. It said on your bio, Nick, that you like the little wobble head things.
Yeah.
I've got a little Donald Trump one there that my daughter went to New York and went... You keep talking about Donald Trump, so I've bought you one of them.
Oh, is that because you're a fan of Donald Trump?
No.
Okay. Really? That'd be awful, no. This is the first time we actually bother asking him, what are you a fan of, Stu? And you go, Donald Trump. And you go, oh, that's a shame.
Stop this before we find out what's next.
That's a shame.
Memorabilia.
So, I've also got the first record I ever bought, which is the first ever Now That's What I Call Music record.
And is that your actual copy from when you bought it as
a
kid?
Yeah. And it's got some cracking tunes on it. And yeah, I was lucky enough to actually interview the guy that set that up, that launched and now that's what I call music thing. And he was quite a kind of mad kind of character that worked in a record shop, a Virgin record shop in the 70s. And the Buzzcocks come into his store where they were selling the Spiral Scratch EP and said, "Oh, we've run out. Like, we need to get some more pressed." So he went into the safe, took some money out from the Virgin, we want a mega store then, I suppose, paid for another repressing, which was obviously totally illegal. But Branson found out and just thought it was quite a maverick strike and was like, "I like this." And then this guy ended up becoming his right-hand man for the whole of Virgin Records. And yeah, and he basically, at the time, all the compilation albums were label specific. So you could never get a definitive greatest hits that had other stuff from other albums. And so Now was the first one where he cut deals with all the major labels and put out the Now That's What I Call Music thing that obviously just become ingrained in our Christmas presents and stuff.
Before that, you had all those like Top of the Pops albums, didn't you? Which were all like re-recordings and things.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
All those weird things. You wouldn't even get the proper song, just, you know, a session musicians trying to do their version of them.
Every time I try and do that cool crate digging thing where like you go through charity shops and boot sales, all you ever see is them retro Top of the Pops albums with like a bikini clad lady on the cover. That's it. Never. And
they're just... love those albums. I used to love them. I'm pretty sure I've got some. Many times I prefer the session musicians to the originals. I don't know what you've got a problem with it. What were Now though? What was it? It was like the number ones of the year, or
no? Oh, just a kind of a big. Oh wait, I can tell you exactly what it is. It's a double album of 30 great tracks, including 11 number ones.
Right. Okay.
So it's like essentially it's an album which is just hit records. I mean, it was a license to print money, and it did. They made like those record companies, or I guess Virgin Records at the time, probably made absolute billions off them, didn't they? They were just so massive.
But I think we had some of the first like Now ones, but it didn't look like that. Hold your one up again, would you? It's I think I remember one where there was sort of like a cartoon of a pig that was leaning over a fence.
Yep. So
is that it? Yeah, that's it. Right, that's what we had. We had it on tape. We had well, that's so amazing. And I actually remembered what it looked like. Yeah, right, okay. So we had that on tape and then we had like Now and Over and stuff like that. But would you say that is, do you have a lot of nostalgic, fond memories for that specific album?
110%. If I hear any track of that, off of that on the radio, I know what track I'm expecting to hear next. No, like when you had the mixtapes when you was a kid that you listened to, and when you hear a song, you just expect the next song to be song from there. That I still get that from there.
Yeah, I had the best of Dr. Hook on tape. And just every single song in those orders just all made sense. And I would listen to it while I was cooking. And, you know, you get those tape decks that automatically play the second side so you don't have to change it around. And it was like that. And then I upgraded to CD. And I never listened to the CDs because they've got more songs. I think there was like... there's like 20 songs on the tape, and then you get like 20 songs per disc on the 3-disc set. But I never listened to them because the running order was always so jarring that it wasn't actually what I wanted out of it. I just wanted those 20 songs in that order. It's weird when you get used to stuff like that.
I'll tell you what's quite good about CDs that streaming's definitely killed, and the hidden track.
Yeah.
When you just like press play and just leave it running, and then like after 20 minutes, some weird kind of racket would just kick in.
Scare the shit out of you.
Yeah. And like, you're never going to get that on Spotify, are you?
No. That is a shame. But it's also sort of like VHS though as well. When, you know, we had Ferris Bueller's Day Off that we recorded off telly, and Muppets Take Manhattan. And those two films go together for me, where you go, you watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and then there's some static, and then Muppets Take Manhattan comes on, and those films a joint together. And that's kind of like, it's, well, I mean, we were talking to, who were we talking to?
Last week?
A couple of weeks ago? Samantha Morton.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
About acting on film, and you've got expensive film that's going through a camera, and you don't have infinite takes because of digital, so you can't go over and over and over again. So you've got to get this performance on film in like three goes, right? Less if you can, right? And so the format that you're actually using in order to capture that performance actually has an impact on the way it's created. And it's kind of like old technology is kind of like, it's not just the fact that Ferris Bueller's Day Off is a good film that I enjoy. It is the fact that the format that it was recorded on has an impact on how I enjoy watching it. And you get that with vinyl, and you get that with and not to sound like a fucking, you know, 90-year-old, but do you know what I mean? The format that that stuff came on, VHS, tapes, records, has a direct impact on how you absorb that that media. And it's weird that that's kind of like, there is a nostalgia to it, but also in many ways it's not as good when you can just sort of like press a button and just
and get speak of VHS, have you got a VHS there, Stu?
I have.
I see this. It is. Oh, The Wanderers.
Yeah, this is a film, and it's come from that. Can you see that? The video collection. That was some kind of weird thing that used to kind of reissue old films on VHS. But
reissue were a bit cheaper, right? That was almost like, it was like a sort of affordable label, I think. I think they were about $9.99 or something, weren't they?
This was $9.99 from Asda. And probably bought this in about 1988, I reckon. Have either of you seen The Wanderers?
No, I've never seen it. But it's one of those ones that I always want to see. It's like... The Outsiders are one of those, isn't it? Sort of same era.
It is. It kind of come from that era when there was lots of kind of like Bronx gang films and stuff like that. And I think, when was it made? 79, 80, I think. 79. And
Richard Price? Is it like a Richard Price book?
It is a Richard Price book, yeah.
What is it? Just for someone that doesn't know anything about it, tell me what it is.
It's an Italian gang called The Wanderers. And basically it's about them at college, and it all culminating in, there's gangs throughout the whole college. There's the Baldies, which is, you guys seen Stir Crazy?
Yeah.
So the Baldies is headed by Grossberger from Stir Crazy. And you've got loads of different gangs, and it's like, but it's not like The Warriors. Whereas The Warriors is really kind of gritty and quite horrible, The Wanderers is just all do what music. It's the soundtrack's amazing. It's got Karen Allen from Wraith Lost Ark, and she plays the female lead in it. And it's just super cool. It's just like, there's loads of like really cool dance kind of like moments at house parties, and it's really cool kind of like, it all culminates in a big game of American football that turns into all of the gangs all arriving in this massive field and having this huge fight. But there's actually really nice undercurrent of stories as well, which is the kind of, you know, which is what Richard Price was good at. I can't recommend it enough. I absolutely adore this film.
We're talking about this last week, this sort of 70s, 80s, and I think it was actually on the podcast you were talking about with Nick on off the beaten track podcast. We're talking about that 50s revival in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Well, it's generational.
Yeah. Mm.
So in the 80s, everyone that grew up in the 50s is making films. So then you get stuff like Back to the Future and Peggy Sue Got Married, because they're all nostalgic for their childhood. So they're making films about their childhood. And then you kind of like get it where, you know, the original Tim Curry It, that's them growing up in the 50s. And then 30 years later, when they do the remake, it's all set in the 80s. Yeah. And then you've got Stranger Things. Everyone's kind of like making stuff about the 80s. It's kind of like, it's weird because people now have the same nostalgia for the 80s that in the 80s they had for the 50s. Yeah. Oh, God, that makes us old. Oh, no. It's when you work out how long ago the Beatles split up and you go, fucking hell, when I was born, They were being split up for 9 or 10 years. And now it's like 50 years. And you go, fucking hell. Oh, God. Anyway, sure. Would you say that The Wanderers is one of your favourite films then?
100%. 100%. I done a podcast called Films to be Buried With. And that was my number one.
Really? Your number one?
Yeah. I love this film.
Why is it 18?
There's some kind of, I don't know if there's really sex scenes in it. There's lots of kind of violence in it. There's lots of, I guess, lots of bad language in it, which probably the way they maybe done the certificates back then may be slightly different to now. I don't know. But yeah, there's nothing particularly sort of, not that I can recall anything. I mean, that's a liar. They actually, they get two of the members from the gangs tie, rocks to bits of string and then tie the other bits of string to their knobs and throw the bricks off of a bridge.
Oh.
Don't worry, the string's too long.
Okay. Oh, wait, it's the fear.
The fear.
The fear. That'll put the willies up. Because I really love The Warriors. I think The Warriors is one of my favourite... would I say it's one of my favourite films? I think it's one of the coolest films. I really, really love that film. It's sort of also, because Karen Allen's also in Animal House.
Yes.
And that's all. And that's circa...
Is she in Porky's as well?
I don't think...
No, that's Cattrall. That's Kim Cattrall. I always confuse them.
Right, Kim Cattrall. Kim Cattrall. I mean, it's weird how many great... I'm not saying Porky's is a great movie.
No one's ever said that.
But she's great in Police Academy and Big Trouble in Little China. I think Mannequin is probably a film that has aged pretty bad. Oh, I've offended him. Not a Police Academy fan.
He's gone too far this time, mate.
So what is that we're looking at? Is that a framed picture?
Yeah, it's a framed picture of the original Police Academy poster from the first ever film, which I'm...
What's weird is, when you've got it in a framed photograph, it looks like you were in the actual Police Academy in that year. That's when you graduated.
Imagine that. Imagine that. Oh, my God. Can I tell you something that happened to me the other day? Like, everybody's... like talking now about these kind of cameo things where celebrities record messages for you, and I hadn't heard about it, but about 6 weeks ago someone knew just how much I loved Police Academy, and I just got sent a video from Mahoney, Steve Guttenberg, telling me that he was in his car listening to Off the Beaten Track podcast.
I saw yeah. that. And do you know what? I was fucking jealous. I was so jealous. In lockdown, well, I've got quite a lot to say about this, actually. That picture that you've got framed, that's a Drew Struzan piece of artwork, and he famously did the Back to the Future poster, and he did like the Welcome to My Nightmare front cover. He did Indiana Jones. He did like loads of Spielberg stuff, and Star Wars and all that. And so he's like this amazing poster artist who also did Police Academy, and I watched all of the Police Academy films at the beginning of lockdown in one day. I did four on one day, which was the Steve Guttenberg set. They feel like an entire
quadrilogy.
Yeah, they feel like an entire series, those four. And then I did the other three, which are a bit bitty, where they're trying to work out what they're doing in five without Steve Guttenberg. And then six is like, right, well, it didn't work without Steve Guttenberg, so we'll cut down the budget. And then seven was like, 5 years later, they've gone, the Russians were like, do you know what we really love? Police Academy. So they gave Police Academy permission to film like the first Western, either the first Western comedy or the first Western movie within Russia after the Cold War. And that was Police Academy 7. And you go like, fucking hell. But those films, I think, that those first four films, the Steve Guttenberg ones are great. And then I went and rewatched Cocoon, because I was just like, I watched Three Men and a Baby, Three Men and a Little Lady. And then I watched Cocoon, and I was just like, what, why... Steve Guttenberg doesn't get the respect that he fucking deserves.
100%. 100%. Mahoney in the first Police Academy film, one of the coolest people ever. When he walks out with that cropped T-shirt.
Yeah, like, burning the oven.
Burning the oven. So cool.
But also, people completely underestimate that Mahoney character has great potential to be completely smug and unlikable, and he makes him totally likable, and he also sort of like he's sort of like the glue that holds that entire cast together. Because when he's not in Police Academy 5 and Jonesy is doing like the emoting and the exposition, you're just like, fucking hell, get him away from the script, because no one else can manage to do like what Steve Guttenberg does in those. I mean, it's sad, isn't it, but what Steve Guttenberg does in those films, right, is it's like a balancing act where he just sort of like, he nails it so perfectly. Like, he's the reason why those films were successful, really.
100%.
Oh. I love him. You're so lucky. Can't believe he missed you. Was it a happy birthday, was it? Or is it just that he was listening to your podcast?
He was just listening, yeah. It was just like, my mate must have messaged him as like, you know, paid whatever it was. But I didn't know all of this. I was just blown away, just thinking, oh, he actually was just like, he's into my podcast. But no, it was one of them cameo things. But I was blown away all the less. Like, I just thought it was amazing. It's like, if you would have told like an 11-year-old me that was desperately sort of trying to do the Jones noises at school, that one day Mahoney would send me a message, never in a million years would I believe you.
That's so cool.
Have you got anything else to show us?
Well, yeah, I have. So I was just trying to think of the things that I was fans of, like, and I was a massive, like, obviously, like, growing up in the 80s, like, I would go and buy like a quarter of sweets from a sweet shop. Mm-hmm. And I'd always get aniseed twists or like cough candies. So I bought some cough candies, or aniseed twists, and I ate one last night, and then I had an allergic reaction, and I've now realised that I can no longer eat the sweets that I used to scoff as a kid. Like, all these little kind of like little blisters come up on my hands, which was really kind of fucking strange. And I was just thinking, why has this happened? And then I just thought,
what a beautiful metaphor for growing up and getting older. You're allergic from the thing that brought you pleasure as a child. I mean, it's tragic as well, but it also shows that you've grown up. It's your this is like your coming of age film, but not a good one. Like, if it's just about eating sweets, he's like, I've got an allergic reaction. That's sort of beautiful. Just we're all grown up. Now, we're all grown up, Stu.
So, and I've got one last item, which is this. So this is me and a drawing that Cunt done from Cunt and the Gang, of me and him. Every Saturday, we used to walk to our local town centre and buy records and just hang around in the shops. But there was a little hardware shop on the way into Grays Town Centre, and it was actually called the House of Essex. And it sold, we had this kind of idea that it seemed to sell the Star Wars toys that no one else sold.
Right.
And before anyone had got it, we walked in, and there he was, Zuckus. And I remember to this day, like, Cunt saying at the top of his, he refers to me as Roy. He was like, fuck my luck, Roy. Look, it's Zuckus. And, and but I mean, that would have been about £1.50. So that was generally like, you know, a couple of weeks pocket money back then. And yeah, we didn't go into town, but we went straight home because we both purchased Zuckus. And so, yeah, on my 40th.
I think that's true. I remember getting like, well, at the time they were Return of the Jedi toys, but these would probably be like, the film had been out a couple of years then. And you would get like, in most like major stores, you'd have the main characters, but I always wanted the other one. And you'd only really find your sort of your characters like that at like markets and things, and they wouldn't be knockoff. They'd be like, they might have been nicked, but they were official merchandise. It was almost like no one else wanted them.
Absolutely.
And that's what I was after. I wanted like, I wanted sort of, you know, what's he called? The bloke who's in America for London with, who's in Jabba's palace with all his,
Bib Fortuna. Like,
Bib Fortuna, exactly. Well done. There's a fan.
who's Zuckus?
He was like a bounty hunter in Empire, I believe. Yeah.
Right, yeah, that's where I've seen him then. He's standing next to, what's the lizard looking one?
Bosch. Is it Bosk?
Bosk. I think it's Bosk. Yeah, right. Yeah, so, right, he's not.
A weird little story regarding Star Wars and Cunt and the Gang. We're literally just starting a podcast this week called Time Bandits, because we've realised in September this year we've been best friends for 40 years. So we're going to do a monthly podcast talking about what happened 40 years ago that month and what it's kind of kicked off. But
oh, my God. That's incredible. That's great.
Great idea.
And so when we first met, my mate's dad was the key grip. His name was Kenny Atherfold. And if you Google him, he's like, he basically was the key grip on Star Wars Empire, Flash Gordon, which actually came out 40 years ago this September.
Who's
my mate's dad.
Your mate's dad?
And he basically worked on, all the Raiders films. And to this day, he still does, like, Bond and done all the Lord of the Rings and all that. But his son, like, moved to our school and I had to hang around with him because he was, like, the new kid. And they said, will you look after him? So I was like, yep, no worries. And but his dad was never there, but he had, like, a drum kit and a motorbike and a go-kart. And I was like, wow, like, this kid's pretty cool. And obviously it was because his dad was always on location filming his films. So we used to play guns, and this is not a lie, I promise you, with the guns and the swords they used in Flash Gordon. And he had a pair of the Wingmen's wings, and they were like foam spray-painted gold. And so he had them at home. So not content at kind of showing off to, like, my mates that was the stuff I'd done, when I met Cunt, I told him that because of this, I was a Jawa, and my dad played 2-1-B medical droid in Empire Strikes Back, which was a completely pointless lie. And I don't know if I was just craving attention or not.
It's not a pointless lie, because it's also good, because it's sort of believable, and it can't prove you wrong.
Yeah.
You can't see it. It could be.
That's the key to good lies, isn't it? Like, Scroobius Pip told me he was on Funask, and I was like, you're joking! And he was like, yeah. Why would you ever question that?
Tell us about Pod Bible magazine. Is this like it's physical media, right? It's it exists in your hands. It's not a magazine, it's not digital.
It was something that, you know, with the podcast, there weren't an enemy or a melody maker, and sort of just trying to find somewhere to sort of help grow and shout about your podcast. There wasn't anything. So I'd kind of messed around with fanzines and stuff growing up. And then I just said to Pip, I was like, look, I'm going to start a little magazine, I think, about podcasts. And he was like, that's a good idea. I'll do it with you if you want. So it always helps, you know, when you got a little bit of sort of podcast royalty that wants to kind of jump in. So, yeah, we kind of launched it February of last year. And then just literally started off doing sort of 5,000 every other month. And me and Pip would stand outside the train stations and tube stations handing them out. And then sort of fast forward to the end of last year, we cut a little deal with the Sunday Times, and we've upped it now to 45,000. And they go out inside the Sunday Times now. And it's just a little kind of magazine shouting about great podcasts and, you know, offering, like, a platform to kind of small podcasts that are trying to kind of get heard. And, you know, and we've been lucky that we've managed to get some really good interviews with, you know, Stephen Fry and Romesh and Buxton and, you know, lots of the kind of big podcast heavyweights. So it's been a lot of fun. And yeah, kind of.
It's hard to think of, isn't it? Because, like, it feels like print media feels like, but 45,000 seems huge in those numbers now, right? That's like, for anything you sort of read about papers and magazines going under every month. And it feels like they're not selling 45,000, are they? Or
no, I mean, it's really weird, because I mentioned the NME earlier, and it was like when you start looking at, like, the stats of, like, the NME in the 90s to, like, you know, into the 2000s, like, the drop off was ridiculous, you know, to the point where, as it was sort of reaching the point where it all just went digital, the print was so small. But, you know, they're all things we thought about. But it appears to be the case, like, niche publications are still popular. And at the moment, you know, to our knowledge, we're the only podcast magazine in existence in the UK. And we did see Le Pod, which was a French version that they'd literally copied us page for page and released it in France, which is quite weird. But yeah, it's been
almost like a pirate version of it, or just like a ripoff.
A complete identical version, like that literally all the different sort of topics on each page were all the same, all the layout was the same, but just different content, but in French.
I imagine that that at the moment, having something that's sort of directing people in the right direction towards podcasts is more relevant than ever, because basically people are just making podcasts during lockdown. I know that doing this is sort of like being a bit of a lifeline for me and Nathaniel to like give us something regular to do, and to kind of, because we didn't do it at first when lockdown first came in. We stopped for a couple of weeks, and then as soon as we started doing it again, it gave us sort of like a real structure to the week. And I think, you know, getting as performers, getting kind of like your voice out there and still being able to communicate with some sort of fan base, it's kind of like, it's been really important, and you know, podcasts are great for that.
It's kept me sane, podcasting. It's like, it's been the one thing in lockdown that's kind of kept that kind of connection with people going. Just like doing off the beaten track and stuff's just been an absolute lifeline. Just throwing myself into it, and just because what has also been a kind of a positive in a very grotty situation is the fact that lots of creative people are sitting indoors with nothing to do, and so you know, whereas people generally wouldn't be, you know, as kind as what you was, Nick, to come into like my little studio and chat with me there, like now you can just, you know, go, look, do you want to jump on Zoom for an hour and talk about records? And it's been really nice that people have been up for doing that. So yeah,
well, good, well done everyone, we've done it. Right, we've got to wrap up now. So, Stu, we've got time to play a game with Nathaniel. Nathaniel, take it away. Explain the game.
Okay, this game, Stu, is called Better or Worse. And you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before. And to score points, it's based entirely on my opinion.
Okay.
Starting with Brian May, Queen. Is Brian Wilson better or worse than Brian May?
Way better.
Yeah, correct. Luke Wilson, better or worse than Brian Wilson?
Oh.
He is worse, but only because he's a high card. Two high cards. Owen Wilson, better or worse than Luke Wilson?
Better.
Better.
Better. Both high cards. Rebel Wilson, better or worse than Owen Wilson?
Better.
Worse, I'm afraid.
Really?
Yeah, love Owen Wilson. Daryl Hannah, better or worse than Rebel Wilson?
Oh, way better. Splash, right?
Kirsten Dunst, better or worse than Daryl Hannah?
Worse.
Uma Thurman, better or worse than Kirsten Dunst?
Better.
Natalie Portman, better or worse than Uma Thurman?
Ooh.
Better.
Yeah, I'm going to go better.
Worse. What? Uma Thurman was in Batman and Robin. Fucking hell, Nathaniel.
That doesn't count, does it? It's a whole career.
You fucking lose points for Batman and Robin, mate.
No. Nicolas Cage, better or worse than Natalie Portman?
Better. Way better.
Nick Nolte, better or worse than Natalie Portman?
Worse.
Oh, down and out in Beverly Hills.
I can't. He's done two good things, including Three Fugitives. So come on.
He's got to be worse.
He is worse, but I'd say he's a high card.
Oh, fuck off. Is he a high card? He's not. Fucking.
It's an eight. It's an eight.
You got eight, right? Well, fantastic. So, Stu, you scored an eight. Which means that you're not as good as Jen Brister, Jason Manford, Joey Scaldini with 10, Ken Cheng, Harry Hill, Luke Morley with 9, but you are as good as Magical Bones, Samantha Morton, Chris Stark, Susie Dent with 8, and you are better than James King, Henry Normal, and Johnny Vegas with 7. So welcome to the club. We've actually got no time whatsoever. So thank you so much for coming on, Stu.
Thanks loads, fellas.
Love to talk to you. I've been Nick. This has been...
Fan Club.
Nathaniel Metcalf, for fuck's sake! And... You've been listening to Fan Club. Thanks for listening. Take care. Write in. Tell us what you're fans of, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you very much.